Putting the Ain't in Saint, you're listening to Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. And now here's your host, Drew Marshall.
Okay, strings. Time to earn the money. Videcki is a beautiful and talented entertainer. She'll be appearing in Atlantic City at the Sands Hotel January 28th and 29th. And this coming Monday night, she has a special on, as they say, another network, entitled Suzanne Summers and 10,000 GIs. She can do a number tonight from a very famous Broadway play called Show, actually, Guys and Dolls. And I think this is only the second time they've allowed this number to be performed on television. Would you welcome, please, Suzanne Summers.
Carson on my show.
It was so nice talking to him.
Do you like that?
Yeah.
Posthumously?
He's a pretty good guest to have on.
Suzanne Summers has played Las Vegas for 36 years and just completed a two-month residency at the Westgate Resort and Spa, formerly the Las Vegas Hilton, where she spent 3 years in the 80s. Do you know that, Tim? Did you know that?
I was just going to look that up.
Most people know her as Chrissy from Three's Company, Carol from Step by Step, the author of 26 books on health and a new way to age. You could use that. Most of them are New York Times bestsellers. She's also a savvy entrepreneur who develops and markets products that improve lives. She's partnered in a whole lot of other businesses as well that create unique products and technologies, again, that improve lives. She started her own one-woman show at the Brooks Atkinson on Broadway and in many TV specials, movies, the whole thing. Most people who've never seen her on stage in Las Vegas really have no idea what she does. Yes, she sings. Yes, she dances. Yes, she's hilarious. It might be why she was chosen as Las Vegas Female Entertainer of the Year. Suzanne Summers will be performing live at Casino Rama on Saturday, May 14th at 8 p.m. Tickets are available right now. Go to CasinoRama.com. Of course, SuzanneSummers.com is another good website you may want to go to. Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone, Suzanne Marie Mahoney. Almost Kathleen Summers. Hello, Suzanne Summers.
Wow. Hi there.
Good Irish Catholic girl that you
yes.
were.
When people used to be able to afford middle names.
I know, we were just talking about middle names on our show.
My husband was too poor. There's no anything in the middle of Al. There's Alan and there's Hamill.
Yeah.
He was raised in a boarding house.
He was.
In Toronto, yes. And yeah. So there just wasn't money for the middle name.
No, there was like 15 people in one bathroom, right? At
yes.
Bloor
yes.
and Spadina or something.
One bathroom. Seven Chinese brothers, a cartographer, a black Nigerian prince. Trying to remember, he talks about this all the time. I've been with him.
He talks.
All my
hold
life.
On. Is he one of these? See one of these guys that says the same stories over the whole? I walked to school uphill, 2 feet of snow, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And the guy, the blind alcoholic trumpet player that he had to share a room with up in the attic, and he had stinky feet, and the window had to be open, and the ice would come in and get on Alan's nose.
Da, da,
I know the
da,
whole
da.
Thing.
Just singing the blues. I cannot believe.
He did okay.
I can't believe you got expelled from Catholic school for writing notes to an imaginary boyfriend who turned out to be a good old Toronto boy. Well done.
That's right. Who knew it was going to be him?
Who knew?
I'd never heard of Canada.
Oh man. Okay, I've got a little riddle for you. Do you mind if I start with a riddle?
Okay.
How many spiritual leaders does it take to marry Chrissy from Three's Company and Canada's leading talk show host?
You're going to start me off with the tough ones,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it took two, a priest and a rabbi.
That's true. How do you know all this? Man, do you do your homework? We did. We had a priest and a rabbi. And people sing Gregorian chant.
Wow. Wow.
I know.
This is the opening line to a joke.
It does, yeah. Okay, listen, I know you're a big deal. You're kind of a big deal. People know you. I get that. But can I just get a couple things out of the way before we actually
yes.
start your
yes.
interview?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. Tell me all about yourself.
No. I want to talk about two guys who I look back
I
on now.
Do it.
No. These two guys, I think, had more of an impact on my life than I gave credit for until I started doing research on you, and I thought, oh, I've got to ask her about these two guys. So let's start with Don Knotts. First of all, Tim Conway told me an unbelievably hilarious story about Don Knotts when they were filming Apple Dumpling Gang, and they were dressed in tutus, and Don Knotts walked into a bar with his tutu on, and Tim Conway was going to get beat up, and it was, I don't know, it was hilarious. So, Don Knotts, do you have just one little anecdotal thing you can share with me? Just one, please.
Oh, it won't be funny.
What?
He was so hysterical. His timing is so perfect, everything, but what people didn't realize, I did two series with Don Knotts. Did you know that?
Yes.
I did a Three's Company. He was he came in as the landlord. And then when I did a show called She's the Sheriff, which wasn't one of my stellar hits, he was back in uniform there.
Wow.
But what nobody realized was he was 98% blind.
Oh,
I know it's not a funny story, but what is amazing about it, he had a person who would walk the steps with him, and she'd say, Mr. Knotts, it's 10 steps to the desk. He'd walk the 10 steps to the desk, deliver the line perfect, then he'd know he'd add another 5 steps to get over to the door. And I watched this with...
Wow.
I was marveled by it, and his timing... You know, if you're counting steps plus, you know, your impeccable timing, that is not an easy thing to do. Genius.
No.
And then he said something to my mother. My mother lost her sight. My mother had 98% vision loss. And it happened overnight. It's called macular degeneration. And I've asked Don if he would talk to my mother. And he said one thing. He said, Marion, a blind person would love to see what we see. And I'll tell you,
nice.
That snapped her out of her funk. And she became grateful for the 2% peripheral vision she had, and it actually changed her whole outlook on everything. So
that's fantastic.
I love Don Knotts.
Fantastic. I'm going to share this story again, Tim. You know I'm going to mention this every time this somebody mentions the blind stuff. 7 years ago, for the last week of Lent, I gave up my eyesight. I had a friend of mine source some contact. He's an optometrist. Source some contact lenses that removed my sight entirely for the week. And normal week, I rode my horse. I had a couple of speaking engagements. I did the show. I walked around the street with the white stick. It was an amazing week, incredible week. So.
What an amazing thing to do, and how we take it for granted.
Oh, yeah.
Having watched my mother, how it, out of her comfort spot, you know, where she knew where everything was in the house, you'd get her into a new environment, and it would break my heart because she'd bang into things. But anyway, I have a Tim Conway story.
Do we have time for Tim Conway?
I don't know.
We always have time for Tim.
That's our motto on the show. We always have time for Tim Conway.
I love Tim Conway, the funniest person on the planet. And we shot Three's Company right next door to the Tim Conway show. So in the year one of Three's Company, I didn't have any idea of how the business worked. That's why Alan gave up his Alan Hamill show in Canada, I think after a year or so of my doing Three's Company when it went to number one, because he said, you really have a shot at something big here, but you haven't a clue what you're doing, and here's why he said this. So I'm walking down the hallway, and Tim comes up to me and goes, hey, Suzanne, I'm doing a special. Do you want to be on my special? I said, yeah. And so he said, okay, we'll send a script over, and we're going to shoot Friday night. Great! So I get home late from work on Friday night, and Alan says, where have you been? I said, oh, I did the Tim Conway special. He said, what? Did you get paid? I said, no. I said, but they said they'd give me some silverware for my silver collection. So, like a week later, a box from Tiffany comes, and it's a fork. So for the next 2 years, I hear from Alan Hamill, great, Suzanne, you're going to do it for a fork again?
Oh, my goodness.
So I guess the moral of that story was that I really needed management.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, just something about Johnny Carson. There's a guy who I know had one of the greatest impacts on my life.
Oh, lucky you. And me, too. I got to be one of Johnny's girls. Do you know how I met him?
Yeah, in the atrium, is that right?
The NBC commissary.
Commissary. I couldn't remember the right French word.
Where you get the food.
Right.
Yeah, I'm bilingual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you married a Canadian.
Right, that's right. I didn't have an agent, didn't know anything. This is when I didn't know anything. I did really well not knowing anything. And I read about a part on the Dom DeLuise show, which was a sitcom, and it described me. And I lived up in Sausalito, and it was me. Small town girl who didn't know who she was, and they described my kind of body. I went, I could get that part. So I got together the $28, which is what it cost then to fly to Los Angeles. And I was just starting to date Alan. And I said, I have an interview at NBC, because the breakdown said when and where and all that. Oh, okay, great. So we pull up to NBC, and what are you here for? I'm here for the Dom DeLuise show. Great, go right, park over there. Bluff is, you know, ignorance is bliss. So I go in, I sit down, and I see all these girls that look just like me, and they walk in and they sign something. So I went over and I signed something, and when I did that, she handed me a script. And it was marked, and I read it, and then they called me in, and when I read, they said, very nice. And I thought, I know, because this is who I am. And they said, well, we're giving you a callback. I said, great. So I go out to the receptionist, and I said, I have a callback. She said, good for you. I said, what is that?
What's a callback?
She said, they're going to call you back. I went, oh, when? Well, I don't know. Now she's getting annoyed. Today? Oh, well, where do I go? Now I'm her problem. She's irritated. She goes, I don't know. Go sit in the commissary. So I go in the commissary. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. No one is sitting there, just me. And in walks Johnny Carson. So he comes up to me and he says, hey, little lady, what are you doing here? And I said, I have a callback. See, now I had some lingo. And I didn't have any 8x10 pictures or anything, but I had gotten a little book of poetry that I had written. I wrote poems all the time. And so I just gave him a book of my poetry. That was Wednesday, Friday of that week. I was booked on The Tonight Show, and I had to write a bad check for the dress because I didn't have any clothes. And I'm standing behind that famous curtain hoping I don't throw up, and I hear Johnny Carson say, we've all been wondering who the mysterious blonde in the Thunderbird is. Well, we found her. And I had thought they loved my poetry.
No.
And the curtain opened, and the audience went, woo. And he just loved me because I was so naive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when'd you get to town? He said to me, I said, today.
Man.
So I ended up doing his show over 100 times.
Yeah.
And my little book of poetry in 1973 became the number one best-selling book of poetry in America, along with another poet called Rod McEwen. And on one of those many, many appearances, Fred Silverman saw me, evidently, and they were looking for a girl on this show called Three's Company. They had tried two. He wasn't happy with them, and he said, I got the girl. I see her on The Tonight Show all the time. So look what one little bit of chutzpah up in Sausalito. I'm that girl investing the $28, and with all my lack of understanding how the business went, that is how my career really took off.
Suzanne Summers, when was the last time you used lipstick to get through a toll, though?
Luckily now I manufacture and sell lead-free lipstick on SuzanneSummers.com.
Beautiful.
It's been an incredible ride.
Well, sure. I mean, we're talking Winston Cigarette Girl, General Motors and Monterey Girl. You got your teeth straightened out, sort of. You were the blonde in the T-Bird, American Graffiti. Fast forward a few years, you're part of one of the best Tuesday night blocks in the history of television. Happy yeah. Days, Laverne and Shirley, Three's Company. You know, I'm thinking about this lipstick through the toll thing again. Hold on. Well, Tim's looking at me because he doesn't know what I'm talking
Sounds
about.
Sounds like a country
so she
song.
Did, I know, lipstick through the toll. So she was crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, I think, right? And didn't. And
I got a call for an interview for a movie called American Graffiti, a small part. And so I had to go, and I didn't have any money. And so I thought I'll figure it out when I get there.
Hmm.
So I get to the toll booth, and I did the, oh, gosh, I forgot my wallet thing. And he said, well, you're going to have to leave something as collateral. And I said, how about lipstick? He said, that'll do. And then I realized, oh, when all else fails,
exactly.
Give him a lipstick.
You know, that's something, I think that's something Lucille Ball would have done. Totally.
I love Lucille Ball's name being mentioned anywhere near.
Well, okay, though, here's the thing, right? The handcuff show, otherwise known as a farce. Have you figured out that word yet? When you were told you were as good as Lucy with regards to comedic timing.
Pretty nice thing for someone to say to me.
Come on.
Great. I know. I had a great sparring partner in John Ritter. We were, I thought our chemistry was magical.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really
do you think? Do you think Lucille Ball knew what subtext was when she first started out?
No. You're talking about my other co-star. She was so trained and the most likely to, and at UCLA, and picked by the scouts, and to get ABC contract and everything. And I come in and I go, I don't know why I'm here. I wanted to be a chef. And I've never studied acting, and so I just went from gut. And she would come in every Monday morning with, on the opposite page of the script, all this handwriting. And I said to her one day, what is that? And she said, oh, that's my subtext. And I remember thinking, it's not that hard. It's like playing house. You be the mother, I'll be the father, I'll be the kid. And, you know, then you play house. That's what Three's Company
is. That's not how I played house.
Because you're Canadian.
Stop it.
I married one of you.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know what? I don't know if this is the right way to describe you, but you are and I don't think I've ever used all these words in the same sentence before. So here we go.
Okay.
Suzanne Summers, you are a postmenopausal breast cancer survivor taking on Big Pharma and Big America.
Yeah, and that's why I played a dumb blonde.
Well, listen, I'm going to be a grandpa this year. I'm also turning 50 this year. I'm 6'4", I'm 235, I'm in pretty good shape. But you and I were eating lunch one day at Tretinoi in Malibu a few years ago. Not together. You were just at another table ignoring me. Just ignoring me. And I said to myself, dang, I want to be like this woman. I mean, girl, who? What am I, 18?
Yes, you are.
Girl is fine.
You rocked the room.
Oh.
I could not stop staring at your calves.
I had better luck than a lot of people. I got cancer. That was such an incredible, not at the moment, but in hindsight, in perspective, it was the life changer for me. It was, what have I been doing? What have I been eating? What have I not been doing right? And so I just totally took responsibility. And when they said chemotherapy, I went, I can't. He said, you'll die if you don't. And I said, I think I'll die if I do what you're telling me to do. And I don't know where I got that courage, but I did it my own way. And that was 2001, I think, a long time ago. I don't even think about it.
Good.
I love the fame that I have, and this is the reason why. You can use it for the better good. And I feel, with all the books that I write, that by keeping myself in shape and my libido rocking, like I always talk about, because I replace all the hormones and no drugs, and that you can be not only inspirational but aspirational to people. And I thought, if I'm going to have fame, let's just make it a win-win for everybody, for me, for them, for you, for the people who read my books. And if it wasn't for the nightclub business, I don't know that I would be writing all these books. It was the nightclub business when I had nothing to do during the day.
Right.
And during the day is when I started pursuing this other passion. And when I'm writing a book, which I do about one a year now, I think about it. Alan keeps saying, because he makes the contracts. Are you writing? Yeah, in my head. I gather. I interview. And then there's like a 3-month period where I just sit there. My back goes out. I get sciatic problems because I'm sitting so long and I forget to stand up every hour. I'm just getting a stand up desk so that maybe this book I won't have a whole back thing. When I go to my physical therapist, he goes, let me guess, you're near a deadline, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm Irish. We either drink or write.
Exactly. Exactly. By the way, do you know what county you're from?
Cork.
Okay. I'm from Tyrone.
You are?
I am.
I
family.
Love being Irish. Do you love being Irish?
I do. I can outdrink anybody.
I drink tequila.
You know what? Suzanne Summers, you cannot drink alcohol after your hellish nightmare of a story. Come on.
I've never had the demon.
No.
And I'd never have had this urge to keep on keeping on when I start drinking. I drink too, but they're stiff ones because it's fun. And the way we drink is Alan will buzz me in my office around 5 o'clock, and he'll say, "You want a date?" Yeah. And we have a bar at our house that's outside that overlooks the desert, and we call it Big Al's Bar. So we meet at Big Al's Bar.
Big Al's Bar. Wait a minute. Did you not have a house burned down?
Yes. Yes. So that's not this house.
Okay, yeah, I just...
Big Al's
thanks.
Bar would be very drafty.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So you being the student of human condition that you are...
Uh-huh.
You know, you've talked about these converging forces in your career over your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got all, you know, this list of, you know, basically, in some ways, you're a walking country song. You know, you have the whole hide in the closet with the cedar chest and lock on the inside of the door because of the violence in your home, the violent alcoholic father, Ducky. Mm-hmm. You're stupid, hopeless, worthless, nothing, a big zero. A big O, you know, a walking apology. You're pregnant as a teen, married too young, got fired because you didn't know enough to look at the camera while opening the fridge. By the way, do you know Alan was fired for screwing up a commercial as well because he burped?
Yes.
You guys were born to be together. You know, around Christmas, you're on a plane over the Bermuda Triangle, and they announce the plane is going to crash. Lord, we're going to die. You've got a younger brother, Michael, who died from a heart attack brought on by drinking. In 2007, you lost your home in Malibu after the fires. I mean, the converging forces in your career have eventually and inevitably led you towards light. But when you're in the funk, when you're in the darkness, other than writing poetry, which was what the darkness is for, I think, in many, many ways, what did you do? Did you ever look upwards in the sky and say, is there a God? Are you there? And if you are, what the hell are you doing?
That's a despair, isn't it? I don't recall having any long bouts of despair. The night that my child, as a single teenage mother, was run over and given a 50-50 chance to live, I would say that was despair. I now know what it feels like. I would have given my life in a second.
Sure.
In a second. But what I learned from that is that every negative in life has an opportunity and light if you look for it, if you don't go into victimization. And this is what happened. He did live, clearly. My doctor bills and no insurance of personal run over it made my life a living hell of bill collectors and horrible things happening. But his nightmares, night after night, screaming, reliving this accident, and I would go in and I would rock him and I would hold him, and I couldn't do what he needed. And I heard about, here comes one of those lucky things, I heard about the Community Mental Health Center, a service where they would charge you according to your ability to pay. And I found this woman, name is Mrs. Kilgore, an angel in my life, and she charged me $1 a visit, which is all I could afford, and that was hard even. And after a year, because she said, in order to work with him, I need to work with you. I said, of course, because I never would have gone on my own. After a year, she said to me, he's fine. He's not having the nightmares anymore. He's well-adjusted. You've been a good mother, which really meant a lot to me because it's real hard when you're 17. And she said, so he doesn't need to come anymore. You, I'd like you to stay. And I said, me? Why? She said, you have the lowest self-esteem of anyone I've ever met. And she began this process of reparenting me, of teaching me that what had happened with all that violence as a child wasn't my fault, because somehow I had taken it on, that my birth brought this horribleness to our family. Because in an alcoholic family, everything revolves around the alcoholic. In
sure.
a normal family, everything revolves around the needs and feelings of the children. So whatever your feelings are in a home like that, you don't ever get to express them. You're just trying to make it through the night. And we did have a closet that we had to hide in at night because he was so violent. So after 3 years of being with this woman, one day she says to me, "I don't want you to come anymore." And I said, "Why? I'm doing so well, and I show up every week, and I pay you every week." She said, "I know." She said, "I want you to go live your life." And she said, "I'll always be here." And I kind of looked at her, and I was stunned because I'd become dependent upon her. And when I got to the door, and I was feeling really sad, and she said, "Suzanne," and I said, "What?" And she said, "The worst is over." And when I left that day, I thought it couldn't get worse. And so it only can get good from here on in. And after that, I'll tell you, it started with the lipstick and the part in American Graffiti and meeting Alan Hamill and Johnny Carson and Three's Company. And in my wildest, wildest imaginings as that little girl who hid in the closet every night, never, ever could I have imagined that this life would turn out like this.
Suzanne, I am looking at the clock and want to be mindful of your time. Would you like me to go away? I have something else I wanted to run by you.
I would like you to do that. I've never had anybody be this prepared for an interview. I so deeply appreciate it.
You're welcome. Tell me about waking up at 3 in the morning to begin a 5-hour burst of writing your life story as a child, keeping secrets, of course, during this visit to the Anasazi ruins in Santa Fe. I want to know where that inspiration came from. You must have, certainly you didn't just go, "Hey, I was inspired. Oh, I'm awesome. Now I'm writing this, and this is great, and aren't I amazing?" It must have felt external.
Well, I'm now working in Las Vegas, and a big success in Las Vegas, and I had to take some time off because I had gotten down to 98 pounds. When you do two-hour shows every night with dancing and everything, again, where did I? You know, I don't know. I wasn't trained for anything, but I don't think I went to a Lionel Richie tribute last month called Music Cares, and I was stunned after all these people covering his songs and singing, and he stood up. He said, "I don't read or write music." And I thought, sometimes the talent is just in you. So I digress. So I wanted to go to Santa Fe. I'd never been there. And I think Santa Fe is one of the most interesting places on the North American continent. And so we went and we stayed at a little inn and outside of Santa Fe, and we heard about the Anasazi ruins. And I love all things Indian, Native American. I always have. I collected even when I don't know why I collected moccasins and things, and that was the tragedy of my fire, that my 45-year collection of Native American things all died in that fire. So I'm sitting, there are these caves, they're cliff dwellings. And Alan goes off, and he's off looking where he's looking, and I'm particularly attracted to this one cave. And I went inside, and you could see the fire marks at the back of the cave. You could feel the family that was in there. And outside was a ledge. And I sat down on this ledge, and the morning sun came down on me, and I looked out at a vista that had been unchanged for thousands of years. Cut to that night, I'm sound asleep, and I wake up with a start at 3 a.m. in a sleep state, lean down. I had a yellow tablet next to the bed. I picked it up. There was a pen. I don't normally do that. I've never done that. And I started writing and writing and writing and writing and writing. And at 8 o'clock, Alan woke up. I'd been writing nonstop for 5 hours. He said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I don't know." And I read it back to him. I was as surprised as he was at what I wrote. It was the first 60 pages of my book, Keeping Secrets, verbatim. I changed nothing.
But where did it come from? Was this just a biochemical surge in your brain that kind of prompted this? Was this, you know, did you have some head trauma, and next thing you know, you're a genius? What was the source of that awakening?
I think it was God.
Do you think there's a God? Because I'm having trouble these days.
Well, it's like, what are we supposed to learn from this? the energy, you know, I grew up Catholic, and they always talked about the soul and the soul. And I thought, what is the soul? And then I read a book by Neil Donald Walsh called Conversations with God. And the description of the soul was, imagine a rock, a large rock. It just looks like a rock, right? But inside that rock are billions of moving parts and minerals and atoms and things. And everything's connected, and it's all connected, and that is what makes that rock. And it helped me to understand what we call God, or what I think of God is. All living things, we are all connected. So something happened in that cave, maybe energy from years and years ago. If you believe in other lives, maybe I was there. I don't know. All I know was I had no control over that book, and sometimes people still talk about that book. You know, here it is. I forget what year I wrote that, but it's been at least 25 or 30 years since I wrote that book. People still bring up that book to me. It's almost like I didn't write it.
This is what I'm saying.
Like I didn't write it. It's my hands just went to that paper every day. You know, and I wrote it longhand because I didn't have a computer and I didn't know how to type. And I literally cut and pasted that book. If I, you know, wrote a new paragraph, I'd literally cut and insert it in with Scotch tape. And that is the tragedy of my fire. That was in the safe.
Oh. Well, hold on. In the safe?
In the safe.
Well, then the safe should be safe. No?
Right. Shouldn't it? The safe blew up.
Where did you buy your safe? IKEA?
This is Alan Hamill getting another great deal.
Canadians.
Right.
Oh, man.
But that, and, you know, you have to follow the flow of the journey of your life. That took me somewhere. That gave me such respect. That book was on the New York Times for 16 weeks. No one had ever told a story on themselves before. And I didn't tell the story of my father. I told the story of me from my perspective, what it did to me, and how I needed to forgive myself, too, for having the ego to assume that I had such power that I brought the whole family down. It was an incredible learning experience, and that so many people have been affected by it is to me, I consider a big privilege.
Suzanne, I'm not quite sure how to word this question, but there, to me, I wonder about the correlation between an abusive alcoholic, you know, I guess sort of Catholic dad. I don't mean to make any commentary there, but the Catholicism came out of the Irish thing, and I get it. So between that and the power-tripping Catholic nuns, although you went back to a Catholic school again afterwards, I don't know what your problem was.
I know, that was a weird one. I think because I got the scholarship.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my question, I think, is with all the problems you've had with religion, or all the grief religion has given you, that might be a better way to say it, combined with not the greatest father figure in the world, what impact do you think those two things have had on you looking upwards to apparently a father God in the sky that's supposed to be all good and all loving and all, I don't know. You know, I hear from a lot of people who have daddy issues or whatever, and they just can't do the father God thing. They can't do it. And then I hear from a lot of people who have grown up in Catholic institutions or religious institutions. We're going to have a couple on later in the show who were abused at a Christian boarding school. And they, of course, have problems with God. Do you have problems with God? That's a horrible way to ask that question, but if I were you, I would.
Whatever God is, to me, is the voice inside me. I've always had this friend inside me, always, in the closet, in the darkest time, in the brightest time. I've never been on stage where I don't, in the wings, right before I go out, say to this voice, without you I can do nothing, with you I can do anything. So I've always had this personal friendship, so I never felt alone. So it's not been about religion. I really, honestly, I don't mean to offend anybody who's practicing, because my whole family is practicing. But I would sit in Catholic church, and I would listen to the priest when I was a little girl, and this is what I would hear. Blah, 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 blah,
oh,
blah,
wait
blah.
A minute. You had the same priest Mr. Bean had.
I never heard a thing.
Right.
And then I remember the nun saying, you know, marriage is for procreation only, and I would think, really?
Only from a
and
nun.
I would question them. Honestly, I don't mean to be corny, but I love men, love them. Love my father. Was he the perfect father? No, but that's where I learned all my lessons. But my marriage to Alan Hamill, it should be written about. He found me, caught me, and he wasn't great in the first 10 years. he was kind of an ass. I was so, it was like in the comic books. I walked into the TV studio and there he was.
But does he still lose the keys to the Escalade when you're out for dinner with Barry Manilow?
Absent-minded a bit.
There's a funny, you may have seen it, a funny clip on YouTube of the paparazzi caught them, and they're out for dinner.
And Barry hates that.
And they're trying to get into the car inconspicuously and take off, and they're kind of hanging around a little bit, not really moving. They're not going anywhere. They don't know where the keys are.
That's hilarious.
Pretty funny moment.
Did you hear Barry Allen?
Allen. Yeah. That's all he had to say, one word.
Yeah, Allen. Whereas for me with paparazzi, I'm everybody's best friend, and I, over the years, you know some of their names, and the TMZ guys, if you're in any parking lot in Malibu, I always feel safe because there's always going to be a TMZ guy there.
Yeah, there's a witness to some, you know.
Yeah, always. And so, you know, when he couldn't find the keys, I'm laughing hysterically. It's so funny. Barry, who can go out in front of 50,000 people, hello, Brooklyn! He, in the parking lot in Malibu with the paparazzi, he wants to crawl into a little ball. That's why, Alan.
Too funny. I want to know if you still don't know anything about astrology, if you still hate backgammon, and if you still don't play tennis.
I do not play tennis. It was such a waste. We had the big whatever here in Indian Wells 2 weeks ago. That must have a name. I'm so out of it, I don't know. And a wealthy friend of ours has, it's beyond money. It has so much money. He bought these seats at the big whatever this Indian Wells tournament is, $25,000 a seat. Oof. And I thought, what a waste on me. This is such a waste. Somebody else should be sitting here. But I went anyway because Serena Williams was, and I wanted to see, I love mastery, and I wanted to see that. And wow. She's strong and she's solid and she's. I was right. For $25,000, you're practically on the court with her, and so I could hear her grunting and the sweat, and I could see it, and it was great. But when it was over, they're very polite. I'm used to, you know, baseball. Yay! They're very polite at tennis,
yes.
And so I lean over to our very wealthy host and I said, did she win?
Wow.
I probably won't be invited back. But no, I don't have a tennis court.
Yeah. I can hear the faux pain. So I read somewhere you were paid $136.72 for something one time. Does that number ring a bell?
The most important check I've ever received. That's what I was paid for... being in American Graffiti.
And yet did you actually tell someone that you didn't like Star Wars? Did you really verbalize that?
Well, I didn't know who George Lucas was. In the first interview, I didn't even want to stay for the interview because I walked in. This is where I had to leave the lipstick.
Yeah.
So
and you were going to get a parking ticket.
Parking ticket, and there's like 200 beautiful blonde girls sitting in the waiting room, and I thought, oh, forget it. And so I say to Gino, the casting, I said, I can't stay. I'm going to get a ticket, and I can't stay. He said, well, Mr. Lucas was very interested in your picture. And I said, yeah. He said, well, let me go see if he can see you right now. I went, okay. So I walk, okay, come on in. I walk in, and there's this little guy. I don't mean with any disrespect, but he's not tall to begin with, but he was slumped way down. So it almost looked like a desk and a head. And so I stand there, and he stared at me, and I stared at him, and I don't know who's supposed to be talking. And finally he says, can you drive? And I said, yeah. He said, thank you very much. So I leave. I thought, what? God. Thank God I didn't wait for all those 200 girls. Mm-hmm. So I drive home, and I walk in my little apartment, and the phone is ringing. And it's my agent, who certainly did not believe in me. She's the one who told me get my teeth straightened and maybe I could get a commercial now and then. And she says, you got the part. And I said, what part? She said, the part in the movie. I said, oh, my God. So that's how I got paid $136.72. Now, in my act that I'm going to do at Rama, I show that clip.
Really?
And I tell an abbreviated part of this story. Because I'm on screen in American Graffiti for a matter of seconds. But when I start on Three's Company, they aired American Graffiti for the very first time on TV, and I remember seeing the ad, American Graffiti, starring Suzanne Somers.
Whoa. It's just weird. Okay, yeah. Listen, I could talk to you forever, apparently, so let me just stop before it gets creepy.
Let me tell you one thing.
Yeah.
Because I...
Am I in trouble?
Yeah. No. I so appreciate this interview. Yeah, really, really... In all my years of being interviewed, I've never had anybody be this prepared. So thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
In my show that I bring to Rama, I'm a storyteller. I sing. I tell stories. I have film clips. I have the very first time that I was ever on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson 3 days after I met him. I have all of that. And I would say this is what I love doing. More than anything, I always have. I did nightclubs in Vegas for 20 years, and then I took a lot of years off to do Step by Step, and I was out on the road from time to time, but mostly writing books. And a year ago, I said to Alan, I really miss it, and it's so interesting that on opening night at the Westgate in Vegas, somebody said to me, are you nervous? And I said, not at all. I'm so ready. I've spent my whole life getting ready because it's an interesting thing to be doing this show at this age. I'm now 69 years old, and I have the energy and I have the vitality, but I also have a perspective that I could not have had when I was doing this in my 30s.
Exactly.
I get it. And I remember, I'm not comparing it at all, but I loved Frank Sinatra, and I knew him pretty well. Not real well, but pretty well.
So when you perform at Rama, are you going to sing from your peep?
Yes. You're so unbelievably prepared. For those listening, Frank Sinatra told me to sing from my peep.
You know what?
I became a better singer.
I Googled what peep was. Don't tell anybody.
You know, I was with Barbara the other night, and I said, did you know what your husband taught me? And she laughed so hard. But what I loved about Sinatra when I went to see his show was the intimacy. It didn't matter how big or how small the room was. You just felt like you were in his living room. And I happened to have had the opportunity to be in his living room many times at dinner parties at his house down here in Rancho Mirage. And I said to Alan, that's what I want to do. I don't want a big production show anymore like I had in the 80s. I want to be me. And I know how to take care of an audience. I know just from the energy I get as I walk out exactly where you're at, what you need. And it's a thrilling art form for me, just thrilling.
Well, comedy is music. It's set up, beat.
Yes.
And since you've always been musical, I can just imagine how funny your show will be as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, get your tickets to this. You got to do it. Go to CasinoRama.com, CasinoRama.com. May 14th, Saturday, May 14th at 8 p.m. Gee, I might even pop up. And
if you do, please come backstage. Just to finish the Frank Sinatra, you have to...
Did I just step in your story?
Or
did you chase a rabbit and we all forgot?
No, it was oh, by the way.
Oh, okay.
With Sinatra,
yeah.
In 1987, my admiring him so much, my wanting to emulate that kind of a performance so much, imagine how I felt when I walked up on stage in 1987 to receive Female Entertainer of the Year Award, along with Frank Sinatra as Male Entertainer, Las Vegas Entertainer of the Year.
As the kids say today, that's cray. That's cray cray.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's ridiculous. Kidding. Well, listen, I wasn't even sure you were going to be able to make this interview after your 8 hours of sleep and taking your Candex and then rubbing your hormone creams on and drinking your tea, your green smoothie with the kale and the spinach and the ginger and the banana and the apple and doing yoga.
All that's out of the way. See, I got it all done before I even talked to you. That's where all my energy is from.
Man.
And I added a new thing at night right before Alan goes to bed. I put a little frankincense oil on either side of his nose and his temples just to, like, go into an even more restful sleep.
Nice. Nice. What?
You know, a big part of who we are and what we are is that we're both on the same health ride. And I eat incredible food. I eat butter and cream and sour cream and olive oil and full-fat cream cheese, all those things. But I eat everything organic. If I can't get it, I bring it with me. And it's all about health. I used to be invited to these, we used to be invited to these dinner parties of a very, very wealthy oil magnate. Wealthy people seem to like me. I don't know why. They must find me amusing. And so I go.
It's because you're a shiny object, that's why.
Yeah, I'm a bright, shiny object.
Yes.
And these parties are always nice. And so with this particular oil magnate, he always made sure that I sat next to him. And I remember one time sitting next to him, and he's in a wheelchair, and his handlers bring him in and sit him down. And I look at this long, opulent table with silver candelabra and the flowers dripping, and then they walk around with mounds of caviar to put on your baked potato, which, you know, I'm Irish. I've never met a potato I don't like. And I look at this man sitting next to me who I can hardly hear him because of his lack of testosterone. He doesn't have any volume. You know, men, that their voices get so thin as they get older, because it's a lack of testosterone, so the estrogen in their body rises, and they actually become feminized. So
right. I know exactly what you mean, Suzanne Summers.
Oh, so that's the problem. Oh.
You're an idiot.
All right.
Sorry, we just had a little bit.
You're the perfect age to start thinking about the new way to age for the next for the next 50 years.
Whoa.
I look at Alan Hamill. I mean, really, you'd never, ever, ever, ever in a million years think that this man was a year away from 80. He's just incredible. And I'm actually going to drag him on stage at Rama. And I don't know if you recall when he had his show Nightcap.
Yes.
But his band leader was Guido Basso. And Guido Basso is going to do a solo with me.
Oh, so fantastic.
It's going to be a fun, fun evening.
Have a listen to this clip and tell me if this sounds familiar at all. I'm not sure if you can hear it, but
okay. Here
we go.
Oh,
have a listen.
The nation's moving forward, can't you see? Oh, Mr. Gordon.
Yes?
Oh, Mr. Gordon.
That's my name.
Your predictions have never been the best. Turn down U.S. funds, we'll lose business by the ton.
There's a bit of a flashback for Canadians.
That's Alan Hamill and Billy Van, right?
That's the hilarious House of Frightenstein guy.
Wow. That show, Nightcap, is really starting to, in retrospect, get its due as the groundbreaking show that it was. And Guido Basso is one of Alan's dearest friends, and he and his wife have become dearest friends of mine. And so he's contracting the band, all Toronto players, which are the greatest, greatest jazz players. And Guido's going to do a couple of songs with me.
Brilliant.
I'm
brilliant.
So looked at, this is like, don't tell Rama. I do it for free. You know
oh,
what I mean?
I'm telling. I'm telling.
Don't tell. This is where Alan goes, yeah, you need management.
Maybe they have a nice shiny fork for you.
Yeah, fork. Yeah, maybe they'll give me a fork.
If we know the people at Rama, it'll be a spoon.
Well, at least a silver one.
I like you.
Thank you. I like you. Really had a nice time with you. Really nice.
It's been quite pleasurable. And can I just say, it was a real pain in the butt researching you, because there's so much stuff, and I get a little, I don't know, obsessed once I start research. I mean, my team starts research. But I did so much, and then I ended up dreaming about you last night, and it just got really awkward. Okay, goodbye.
Will you please make your way backstage at Rama if you come? I'd love to meet you, and I know Alan would too.
That would be a real privilege. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Suzanne Summers, Casino Rama, May 14th, 8 o'clock. Be there. Suzanne, thank you again.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, we went a little overtime there, but...
A lot overtime. But that was worth it.
She's so fun.
Oh, yeah.
Have a listen to Suzanne Summers sing on the Johnny Carson Show so many years ago when she was 4 years old.
Just no living without you. Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery, 'cause if you go, then I'll be blue. Breaking up is hard to do. Remember when you held me tight and you kissed me. Think of all we've been through. Breaking up is hard to do. They say that breaking up